We sort of gave, in a nutshell, I'll tell you what we taught them so you can remind them. And you won't have any problem doing that. Just two words, always lose. In the Christian life, when you lose, you win. And we always want to lose. I want to look today at marriage and conflict in marriage, and Scott and I are going to do this together, and just some of the things that we see in marriage that cause conflict. And I want to look at two aspects of our being. One has to do with the self-life or the flesh life that we bring into our marriage. The other has to do with the temperament life that we bring into our marriage. And both of those things have a tendency to cause conflict. Before I move into that, I want us to have firmly fixed in our minds, though, that the purpose for marriage is not happiness. Now, in everything in life, there is a primary purpose and a secondary purpose. A good example is an automobile. The primary purpose for buying a car is that that car will get you from point A to point B. Secondary is if the car is nice, if it's pretty, if it's attractive, if it's comfortable. But if you make the secondary reason the primary reason, you're going to end up with something that looks real well, but you can't leave the driveway. And many times we confuse the purpose of marriage. And the purpose of marriage is not primarily for you to be happy. The primary purpose of marriage is to work the flesh out of you and let Christ's life be expressed through you. It's taking two rough rocks and rubbing them together until they smooth out. And if that's the purpose of marriage, it's really nice that I can go through that rubbing with someone that loves me and is committed to me. And as Christian couples, one of the first things that we can resolve is that we are not going to hinder God's process. We're not going to get in the way, and we are not going to consider divorce. Now, I look at marriage as a 20-year course. So we're in a university town, and most of you know what courses are like. You enroll, and marriage is a course you enroll in that's pass-fail. Now, if you go through a course and you've really had to struggle, and you've taken 6 months of this course, and you've got another 3 months to go, and it's really going to get tough to finish it up, and you go ahead and drop out, that's not very wise, because you know what you get to do later on? Retake it, because you can't graduate without it. So you get to start over again and go back through it. And marriage is just that kind of a course. There are several purposes in marriage, but the primary is to get self-life out of the way, self-centeredness, all my little pettiness, being controlled by the things around me, and bring me into Christ's control and Christ's life and have it expressed. And too many people bail out early on in the course. They quit. They can't take it. And you know what they get to do? They get to enroll with someone else and start the whole thing over again. And I've often said to my wife, I don't want to have to go all through all this again with somebody else. I just don't want to. One of the things that turned a marriage around that I was working with and discipling in is when the husband finally said to his wife, honey, no longer will we discuss divorce or separation or leaving. We're married for life, and the Lord's not letting us out of this. And that's our commitment. And in every conflict, it'll reveal something in you. So one of the things I'll do in marriage discipleship, someone will come in, and they'll list off all the things that are wrong with their mate, and I'll say, for argument's sake, I'm going to agree with you. They're that bad and worse. Now, what's your excuse for acting that way? Why are you acting the way you are? And this is a beautiful thing in the Christian life, and that's what makes discipleship so absolute, is that no one ever has an excuse. No matter what anyone's done to you because of what Christ has done for you, you never have an excuse, and I want to keep that in the back of your mind. Not only are we committed in saying we're not going to bail out of this, we're going to let God do His perfect work in us and work this self-life out of us. We're going to allow all of those things to take place. And we're committed in this thing. We're going to stay in, let Him do His work. Now, I want you to think of marriage like this as we move into this, because I'm talking about an eternal purpose in marriage. And primarily, again, it's not happiness. This is interesting to me. In Genesis, it says God created man, and it's singular. And that man's name was Adam. Adam was a male and a female in one body. Now, that doesn't mean he could win the Pee Wee Herman look-alike contest. It just means that he had the characteristics of male and female within him. And so God looked for a helpmate. And Adam looked around and there wasn't anybody that could be a helpmate because he was complete. And God said, this isn't working too well. He needs a helpmate, but he's complete. So what God did is he took female out of Adam. Now follow me just a minute. A man, singular in the Hebrew, was Adam. He was a male and a female. As soon as God took the female characteristics out of Adam, Adam stopped being a man and he became what? A male. He was now incomplete. He was no longer a total being. And it says a second time then, and God created man, and it's singular again, male plus a female. One man equals a male and a female together. And that's why Paul makes the point that if you're not married, God gives a special gift for that to fill up what is lacking in you. A male and female equal one man. Here's the best analogy of that. Job, or Satan, comes to God and says, let me work over Job. And God says, yeah, go ahead and do it. And you can do whatever you want to Job, but you cannot touch his life. So Satan goes out, and he takes his crops, his flocks, his children, his servants, his health, and his wealth. There was just one thing that Satan did not take from Job. There was only one thing he didn't take. You remember what it was? His wife, because Satan knows his wife is his life. You can't touch the life of Job. Now, believe me, if Satan could have taken his wife, he would have. And when she's out there telling him to curse God, Job might have wished he had up. But he wasn't going to take him because his wife was his very life. And we need to see that in marriage, the two become one and they're one man. They're one purpose, one person in Christ. And our differences, instead of being grounds for divorce, are the greatest grounds for oneness that we'll ever know. And the world continues to look for somebody like them. But in taking female out, he took the opposite out. And as one fellow told me, if you want to be successful, subcontract your weaknesses. Don't get people around you that are just like you. So God has given you a mate that is opposite to you. And here's an exciting thing. If you, and I just want you to think of this as a loaf of bread, if you allow leaven, the leaven of the Holy Spirit into your life, you've allowed it into the whole loaf. Don't ever allow the enemy to say to you, I'll lose when he loses. I'll give up when he gives up. I'll start acting better when she starts acting better. I'll start showing affection when she can show affection. I'll be obedient when they're obedient. Because if God is laying on your heart to lose and to love and to be obedient, he has called you into the blessing and the abundant life first, and let it into your life, and it'll move into the whole being, and the unbelieving mate can be sanctified by the believing mate. That's what Paul teaches. So as we lose, as we learn the spiritual principles, it's leaven in the whole thing. And that's why Paul says, husbands, if you love your wives, you love yourself. And nobody'd walk around hitting themselves in the eye. And no one should walk around abusing themselves. And yet, many times we're perfectly happy to abuse the other person, and we're the one that suffers. It's bad enough that we have to go through our lives with the enemy standing behind us in that first-person singular voice with an Oklahoma accent accusing us without having our mates accuse us. And we have to see that we're in this thing together, that we want to grow together, and we want to be perfected together. So we're committed to that. Now, I want to look at these two elements that we bring into marriage. I'm going to look at one, and Scott's going to look at the other one. When you come into marriage, you meet at this point, and you've got the... I've said before, I can't draw very well, but I can't talk if I can't draw. But you got the man and woman, and they meet, and both of them have a bag, two bags. They're carrying these two bags into the marriage, and they're both invisible bags. As I've said, I told my wife, my daughter's going to marry someone exactly like me, and she said, no, she isn't. And I said, well, you just watch, I'll bet you she does. Because when she leaves the house at age 30, she's going to take with her a little invisible bag called Tricks for Men. And those little tricks are only going to work on this kind of a man. At age 16, I can promise you that she knows how to manipulate me, how to control me, how to let me have her way. She knows when she's pushed me too far, and she even knows how to handle my rejection. And she's going to look for that kind of person. And what's interesting is often we create the very thing in our mate that we hate because we're used to it. And if you grew up, you fellows, with a cold, withdrawn mother who didn't hug you or kiss you, you, in covert ways, will often create that in your wife. You'll make her that kind of person because you know how to handle that. And if you gals grew up with a passive father and a dominant mother that was in charge and took over all the time, even though you're saying, you're the godly man, you're the head of the house, you take over, underhandedly and covertly, you're making your husband passive all the time. You want to create in him what you're used to. And it's sort of our misery zone, and it's our comfort zone. And Scott will look at that, at some of those things for us, because in that invisible bag, we have several flesh patterns. And those flesh patterns begin to collide. And we have those grids of emotion that we take into our marriage. And of course, one of the things that would help a lot of marriages is if you would believe your mate when they tell you something. Just believe them. Because we spend a lot of time saying, that wasn't what I meant. But we're not in that person's shoes. And we perceive it a different way. And some of you heard the illustration I used of the girl who grew up and her mother had died. It was her job to take care of the father and the three boys. And every night she'd do the best she could cooking. And the father would find something wrong with the meal. And he'd take a bite and say, honey, you didn't have enough salt. If you don't learn how to cook, you'll never be a good wife. The next night, honey, it's too much salt. You don't learn how to cook, you'll never be a good wife. It's underdone. It's overdone. She grew up with that. So she gets married, and she's been married a couple of months, surprises her husband with fresh baked biscuits before church. He takes a bite out of the biscuit and said, you know, honey, that could use a little more sugar. She threw the biscuits at him, the whole tray, told him to find a woman that could cook. She was leaving. And stomped out the door, got in the car, squealed off in the tires. He's holding this biscuit just watching her go down the street, and he's thinking, I could have went ahead and eaten that and just shut up. He said something that on a scale of 1 to 10 was a 1 for him, but a 10 for her because of her grid of emotion. And if you feel like you're a failure and you're worthless and you're unacceptable, you look for messages to prove that. So if your mate tells you the simplest thing, Like, could we get a different kind of toothpaste? They're liable to blow. Because it's filtered through that grid of emotion. And you take that flesh into the relationship, and that begins to hammer against each other. The other thing we bring into the relationship is a temperament pattern. Now, flesh can be dealt with at the cross. Temperament can only be understood. You can't change it, because temperament is part of your created being. It's what God put in you. And you'll have as much luck changing your temperament as you will your hat size. You're not going to get it done because it's part of you. That's what God created you with, a certain amount of temperament. And it can't be changed. So we come into the marriage with our temperaments, and they collide. We come in with our flesh life. We come in full of self and self-centered, and pretty soon we begin to spread in our relationship. And we can even come to a point, if it spreads far enough, that we enter into what I call emotional divorce. And let me explain emotional divorce to you. It's where, with my mind, I run away from divorce. I'm not going to have one. I'm a Christian. I'm married. We've got children. We can't have a divorce. But with my emotions, I go ahead and divorce. And I'm in conflict. And someone who is emotionally divorced, to justify how they feel, and what they basically come to the point of believing is that this person can't meet my needs, and it's hopeless, and they'll never help me, and I can't please them, and it doesn't matter how much I try, and they're just making me sick, and they like to push my button, and on and on and on, all the thoughts that we've had. And I was telling Scott, I found this really interesting, that I can be in a third world country, speaking through a translator, doing marriage counseling, and the fellow will say through this translator, well, I just can't please her, I just give up. There's nothing I do that's right. And I've heard that in 40 countries. There is a consistency in the way the enemy works. There is a consistency in our self-life. And so we can come to this point of emotional divorce where we say, they can't meet our need, I'm giving up on them. Now at that point, we'll usually withdraw from our mate sexually and not want anything to do with them. And it's an interesting statement. And Paul says it's good to be apart for a while for prayer, but then it's not good to stay apart. I don't really understand all the dynamics, and I work in that all the time, of the sexual relationship in a marriage. But I do understand this, it's not good to be apart. And when people are apart, there begins to be more and more dysfunction, more and more punishment of the other person. And as I mentioned to the fellows this week, I believe it's a lie when we say that sex is physical for a man and emotional for a woman. It is 1,000 times more emotional for a man. And if you want to test that out, when your husband wants to go to bed with you, reject him and see what he does. You've never seen such pouting. You've never seen anyone so upset. And then they're really going to reject you, and just to show you that they really don't need that, they're not going to touch you, and they'll go to bed that night with their back to you. And they're laying there in bed just steaming and thinking of all these thoughts, and why are you treating me this way, and I don't have to take that. And I'll show you I don't need this stuff, I just won't do it. Now, if it's just physical, I don't think you'd see that. But it's actually emotional, because it's tied up in a man's acceptance. That is the ultimate acceptance you can give a man. And I've recommended to some women, if you really want to show your husband that you love him and accept him after he's been beat down all day at work and had a rotten time, go rape him. And that'll say a lot to him. That'll really say that he's got some acceptance, that he's wanted, that he's needed. So that's tied up with that. But normally, under emotional divorce, we begin to withdraw from each other. And then to justify our rebellion against God, we start thinking of intellectual reasons on why I shouldn't be messing with the bum after all. And everything my husband does or my wife does on a scale of 1 to 10 now becomes a 10. And the enemy's really into high gear. He's really having fun with this. He can whisper anything he wants. He's got free rein. Now, at some point, you've got to say, this is insane, and I'm going to start to move this way. And the way I move back to a point of oneness, and I believe this is a fairly normal cycle that we go through in our marriage, we move back through the cross and through understanding. Now, let me give you an example so you see what I'm saying. I've got a friend, and she grew up with a lot of insecurity, a lot of feelings of failure and feelings of being stupid, unacceptable, dumb, and slow. She was held back 1 year in school, although she is quite bright. She recently tested out in the airlines, and she got the highest score of a class of 600. And it was some pretty difficult stuff. But she feels dumb, so it doesn't matter what her test says. Not only that, she has a melancholy temperament. You might call that an analytical temperament. Another title for that would be a C temperament, as we'll look on our test that we're going to take. Now, the melancholy temperament defines love a little differently. And the way we look at that is, every one of you today has a dictionary in your heart, and in that dictionary you have definitions. So you, normally, and here's just an example, you pull the dictionary out of a man's life, and you look to love, and you turn to that, and you read it, and it says sex. But you pull the dictionary out of a woman's life, and you turn the page on that, and you look up love, and it says to do a nice little thing for me, to give me a hug, to bring me a flower, to do this. Special. And what we normally do is we love others according to our definition of love. So my wife is one of those melancholies that does little things for me. And I'm not a melancholy, so I don't think in terms of little things. I don't do anything. And she comes around and says, I really don't feel like you're loving me. And I said, I don't get it. I've been ready to have sex every night. I've been loving you according to my definition. But see, we have two different definitions. This gal is a melancholy. She defines love as little special things. Plus, she's insecure. Her husband calls her up, and he owns a big company, and he said, meet me at McDonald's for lunch. I want to see you. And she is fuming. Now, I got to admit, if anyone invites you to McDonald's for lunch, you have a right to be upset. But I don't think that you ought to leave someone over that. And she's really upset over this. And they show up at McDonald's, and man, she is mad because there's nothing special about McDonald's. And the day before that, he took a business associate to a $50 a plate lunch. And she's really upset that he took her, or he took this fellow there, and he's taken her to McDonald's. Now, this guy's real busy, and for him, he was showing love because he took time out to go there. It was a big deal for him. So I showed them the differences in their temperament, and that's what I'm working on this afternoon. Differences in temperament. That she defines love as little things. This fellow has built her a house that many of us would absolutely love to be in. It's up in the mountains, and I haven't seen any homes this pretty. And it's a huge home. It's a beautiful home. It's worth thousands of dollars. And she hates it. She walks around it mad. And you know why she's mad? He didn't ask me where to put that spice rack, you know. He just put it in. He didn't ask if I wanted cupboards over here. He just put them in. And I wanted the towel rack 3 inches higher. He didn't ask me. You think he'd ask me? He just put it in. And she goes through this house that he thought he was giving her as a gift, and she's mad about it the whole time. So I explain the differences in temperament. Do you understand that this is how your wife is? That that's not going to change? And I really want us to distinguish between flesh life and temperament life. Because one can be denied and the other can't. It's sort of like the thing sometimes today, people confuse deeds of the flesh with demons. and they try to cast out deeds of the flesh by calling them demons, and that isn't going to happen. A fellow here not too long ago was casting out the demon of poverty over the phone. I tried to get his number, but it was busy. But he's going to get rid of that. Well, poverty isn't a demon. And you can't get lust cast out, because lust isn't a demon. Those are called deeds of the flesh. And you can go crazy trying to do that. In the same way, there's a self that has to be denied. Scott's going to talk about that, our flesh life, our old pattern, this invisible bag we bring into the marriage called tricks for marriage. But there is a temperament life that cannot be denied. It's what you are. So I explained to her that she was a melancholy temperament, that she had a tendency of defining things of the small and the important and the special. And your husband, on the other hand, is more of a driver, and he just wants to be with you. He gave you his time. He drove across town. He was saying, I love you. And I really worked with them to get in the other person's shoes. Would you just get in their shoes and for an instant understand what they're like? A melancholy temperament rarely talks because their mind is always working. They're thinking all the time. On the other hand, the sanguine or expressive temperament talks all the time, and when they don't talk to you, they're mad. So what we have a tendency to do is, you who judge others practice the same thing. For 10 years of my marriage, when my wife wasn't talking to me, I was mad at her because I assumed she was mad at me, because if I wasn't talking to her, I would be mad. Does that make sense? And all the poor girl was doing was thinking. She was just thinking. But I couldn't get in her shoes and understand that. And once I got in her shoes, that really helped. So I let this couple get in each other's shoes and say, do you see how you perceive that? And there's nothing wrong with that. We need the differences that we've given, that God gives. And they said, boy, that's freeing. I really like understanding that. That's great news. And boy, they were happy and they were ready to go. See, we dealt with temperament through understanding. And they had understanding and they were moving this way. And I said, just a minute, I'm not through with you. Sit back down. And I looked over at this gal, and I pointed my finger at her, and I said, I want you to tell me something. Where do you come off getting mad because your husband took you to McDonald's? What's your excuse for that kind of behavior? What are the commands in Scripture concerning you and your marriage? What does it mean to lay down your life and lose, and when you're offended, to bless somebody else? And I grabbed the Bible off my desk and threw it in her lap, and I said, you prove to me your behavior. What are you doing with that? Well, her husband was enjoying this. He was sitting there. He thought, boy, this is great. I never did think she was submissive. And he going on and on. You just see the wheels turning. And she said, I don't have an excuse. I said, yeah, I'm going to tell you something. If you would have taken up the cross and taken seriously the principle of death brings about life, and you wouldn't have saved yourself, we would have never come to the point where we needed understanding. It could have all stopped. And I said, I want you to know something. You are out of order, and I'm disappointed in that. And he was nodding his head, and I looked over at him, and I said, now give me that Bible, and I threw it over in his lap. And I said, now where do you come off getting mad at her because she's mad at you? How come you didn't keep loving her? How come you withdrew from her? How come you decided to punish her? How come you got angry and mad and rejected her? Just prove your behavior to me. What's the Bible say about husbands? It says love your wife. And I said, but you weren't loving her. You were disobedient. And that's why you're so empty right now. So you see, there are two things that bring us together. The cross and understanding. And actually, if you'll have the cross working in your life, you don't need the understanding. If you have the attitude in you that was in Christ and you lay down your life for everyone around you, you can release life and you don't have to have the understanding. The reason I go over this material is, no matter what I do to my wife, she doesn't have an excuse. She needs to love me. But why do things to purposely annoy her? Why do things that really bother her? Why just bug our mates and make them take up the cross? There's no question we need to, but why do those things? And then there's a lot of other problems that come in with not understanding what our temperament is. As we move into temperament, let me show you one more thing so you know what I'm talking about. Temperament is your unique self. That's the created self. That's the uniqueness of God. The analogy we use is that of a prism. Every prism is different, but every prism does the same thing. It receives light and displays it. And you're a prism and you're different. And you exist to receive the life of Christ and to display it in a unique way that's uniquely you. And I absolutely love the uniqueness of God's people. And in some ways, the stranger they are, the more I enjoy them. I don't want everyone to be the same. And I love, my favorite temperament's a perfectionist temperament. I just love it. And I got a friend of mine that takes me bowling. He's a college professor. And here's all these Hell's Angels over here bowling. You know, the guys with the beer bottles swinging in their thumb, finger, going back and forth, and they're blowing smoke on us. And they go bowl, and every time my friend goes up to get his ball, he gets the air freshener out of his bag and he leans over and sprays it in their face. Now, I gotta admit, it's exciting because I never know if I'm gonna make it out of there alive or not. And it's a lot of fun. And he says, well, if the cigarette smoke annoys me and that's dangerous, they can just be annoyed by this. And they're staring at us and don't do anything. Turner talked about a melancholy we had with us at the cabin. When it came for him to give prayer requests, we said, do you have any prayer requests? And he said, no, I don't, because I don't like anyone in this room. I think you're all phonies and you're all out to get me. And you just can't trust people. I kind of enjoy that. One of my favorite guys when I was at Kansas State University had a Volkswagen station wagon with two speakers mounted on the front and a CB hooked up to it. And he was really eccentric, and man, I had a ball with him. We'd go over to eat at their house. They had 5 dogs and 15 cats. And you sit there the whole time like this. Yeah, I really liked that salad. That was good stuff. And but that's basically how you ate over there. And it was always fun to drive around town. And he had this thing, and he was sort of on patrol. And I'd be at a stoplight, and I'd hear this, Mike, Mike. And I'd look around, and here in traffic everywhere, and there he'd be in the Safeway parking lot. I want to check that right rear tire. So I'd get out and go around and go to the right rear tire and kick it a couple times. Looks okay from here, go on. You'd thank him and get in the thing. People like that, to me, are a delight. They're a lot of fun. That kind of stuff does not bother me one whit. There are a lot of unique selves, and we want that in people. And the unique self is made up of talent, ability, intellect, temperament, or maybe even personality. And God gives everyone, here's how I see this, 10 units total of this. That's what you get, 10 units. Now, some people have 7 units of talent, 1 of ability, and 2 of intellect. They got 10 units. Other people have 8 units of intellect, and maybe 0 in the area of talent, and maybe 0 in the area of ability, but they have some personality traits that are 2. But God shows no partiality. And if anyone boasts, let him boast in the Lord. He's made each one of us uniquely us, and you don't have anything to boast about. And it's unfortunate today, for some reason, we want to boast all the time in the person's intellect. the grandparents can't wait to tell you how smart this child is. You know, in a recent survey, it said that after doing this thing for several years, that A students work for C students. That's a fact. And all I'm saying in that, I'm not saying intellect isn't important. I'm just saying we need to balance this out and say nobody's got any more than 10 units. And they're just in different areas. And you don't need to feel inferior because you don't have as many intellect units as somebody else. God has not shown partiality when it comes to you. And we have nothing to boast in, no matter how much we have anywhere. And there's a lot of inferiority that's been worked into children because of that. Maybe that's close to home to me. I have one child that's got about 10 units of intellect. And I got another one that's got about a half. And he really has a hard time. He's just now at age 12 reading at about a second grade level. Real fun guy, a lot of talent and ability, and he's a real delight to be around. But I've had to watch this guy go through 6 years of school of being called retard and stupid and no good and on and on and on. And he's really come through it pretty well, but we've had to emphasize he's got as many units as anyone else. So I just want to say that God gives us this unique self. Now, the Bible is awful confusing because it says this. Kill yourself. Galatians 2:20. Deny yourself. Luke 9:23. Now let's really compound it with Matthew 19. Love yourself. Does that confuse anyone other than me? If it's bad enough to kill and if it is dead, why in the world do I need to deny it? And if it's bad enough to kill and deny, why am I supposed to love it? That gets a little confusing. And Jesus says this, you ought to love your neighbors, you love yourself, and that's why so many of you have neighbors that are in big, big trouble. Because you don't love yourself. And when people are critical, that's always a sign of lack of self-love. So we have self number one, self number two, and self number three. Here's how I believe this clears up. What they're talking about in scriptures is not the unique self when it says kill yourself. Not the unique self when it says deny it, because you can't deny it, it's what you are. What they're talking about is the source or the driving force behind the self. So let me use an example. This self here that needs to die is the Adam life, the old nature, or the old man. Let's take a driver for example. The Apostle Paul is a good sample of a person who is a driver. He's a choleric. He's really motivated. He's ready to go. And Paul was a driver before his conversion, and he was a driver after his conversion, right? He drove to kill people, then he drove to save them, but he was still a driver. But that ability to drive becomes distorted when the old nature or Adam life controls it. It'll distort it. Now, here's another man that is a driver, Hugh Hefner. I believe that he was created by God to start churches. We're all in the womb given talent, ability, and intellect, and he's a driver, and I think God really wanted him to start churches. But he had a lot of female rejection in the past. He had a mother that rejected him. He's got an Adam life that hates God's commands. And so he went out there and began to milk acceptance out of women. And instead of starting a church or leading people to Christ, this unique self became distorted. And instead of a church, we end up with Playboy magazine. Does that make sense? Now, believe me, he doesn't ask people to work for him. He tells them. He's a driver. He tells them how to get going. And this poor fellow, not only is he going to go to hell, he gets to live in hell every day. Now, the only way out of that is to kill this life and crucify it. And what we talked about today is even though the old life is gone, the baggage of it remains. Even though your relative dies, your mother or your father, you go in their room and their baggage is still there. So all the remembrance of coping can remain in the baggage. And that's why we're called to renew our mind. We remember those things. We'll take example of another driver. Jim Baker is a real driver. He's a guy that had a lot of drive. There's no question about that. And I don't question the fact that he's a Christian. But I believe he wasn't denying self. That's quite obvious, the baggage of the self life and the old ways that he'd learned how to cope. And that controlled his unique self. And since he was too spiritual to go start Playboy magazine, he started the PTL Club, which did the same thing. And this fellow will go to heaven, but he lives in hell. And I don't judge that guy because I feel sorry for any bondage that he was involved in. He really was in a lot of bondage. He didn't know the secret of denying self, and it completely controlled him. Still, a distortion. This self we crucify, the baggage remains, and we deny it each day. And that's what this fellow's been talking about the last 2 days. The third self is when we deny this, we now allow Christ's life to control my temperament. And in whatever I do, I'm a blessing. Unique self is like a hammer. A hammer is not good or bad. What you do with the hammer is good or bad. If you build an old lady a house, it's good. If you kill her, it's bad. Now, we can take some of the traits, say, of a perfectionist or a melancholic, and they are, by creation, critical. If Christ's life is ruling in their temperament, that criticalness is a positive, positive trait, and we need those people in the church now more than ever. Because they sit back and say, I'm not so sure I'm going to listen to what this guy's saying. I've got to judge it out. Another good term that I like best for a perfectionist is analytical. They think through it. And they have a little list, and if the guy doesn't fit into that, they're not going to jump on the bandwagon right away. That is a very positive trait. But under the rule of self-life, that criticalness creates a bunch of lists, and if my husband hasn't kept everything on the list, or my wife hasn't kept everything on the list, they're rejected. And not only that, I create lists for myself. And the criticalness that was to be positive and used in the church and in the body of Christ becomes a negative thing, and it's turned within, and I'm critical about myself. And a distortion takes place there. So temperament is not good or bad. What makes it good or bad is whatever rules or controls in it. Now, a lot of the conflicts that we have in marriage are temperament conflicts. That's what I'm dealing with, as opposed to flesh. Let me give you an example. An analytical, this is the Empire State Building. An analytical person will often grow up, or a perfectionist or a melancholy, thinking they're stupid and slow. And the reason they think that is because they have to go through a process of thinking. And they go through that whole process, and it takes them a while to get through it. And if you really want to frustrate them, just keep shifting gears on them. Talk about point A for a while, and before they can finish that, switch to point B. And they just feel like people just talk around them. And if you're married to one of them, you think, would they please get on with it? I asked my wife, hey, my lunch appointment canceled. Grab your coat and purse and we'll go eat lunch together. Analytical in her. Used to think it was slow. Now I know it's just being analytical. So she, say, is analytical and down here, and I'm more the choleric up here, and I'm real active. I want to get things going. In fact, I don't even want to think things through. I'm impulsive. Let's do it right now. So I yell down at her, and I say, would you step up the pace a little bit with this thought process? I mean, we've got to make this decision this year. And if I wait more than 30 seconds for the decision, I feel like I've waited a year because, see, I live up here. So she says, yeah, okay, I'll try to be faster. I'll try, and they appear to be passive, and they're not passive. They're thinking. But they're accused of being passive and not acting. She goes, okay, I'm going to pick up the pace, and I'm going to go up here to the third floor in passivity. I was passive down here, and now I'm going to move up three floors. That's a 300% improvement. Quite a bit, huh? I'm on the top of the Empire State Building. Does she look any closer to me? In fact, she worked and worked and worked to go three floors, and you know what my response for all her effort is? Are you going to move or not? Are you going to get with it or not? And she says, rain on you. I was happy down here. That didn't help any. I worked and worked. It didn't help. And she's saying to me, would you please slow down? Would you please stop? Would you think? They don't mind going along with you in a decision if you'll give them plenty of information about the decision. But I don't have time to do that because the decision should have been made yesterday in my mind. So I slow down, and I mean I work. It's three floors down here. And I hang out the window and wave at her, and I'm really proud of myself because I waited 30 minutes before I made the decision. It's a 300% improvement. That's a lot. And she looks up at me, and do you think I look any closer to her? And her response is, I'm never going to change. So I go right back up here to where I'm happy, and we continue to discourage any kind of growth or movement in our mate's life because we can't get in their shoes. And I've actually come to a point where I appreciate where my wife is, and I want her to stay right there, and she likes where I am, and I can stay right there. She says about me, and she says, I'm not joking about this. I want you to know I will never call the police until you're at least 3 days late. Because you're usually down at the gas station sharing with somebody. You're sidetracked at the grocery store. All of those kind of things. And I was getting ready to leave on a 3-week trip. I was going to Africa. And she said, I had a layover in Cairo and one in Nairobi, and then I got on where I need to go. And she says to me, what's your plans in Cairo? Where are you staying? I said, I don't know. I'll get off the plane, get one of those Arab cab drivers. They'll find me a place around there somewhere. You don't know where you're going to go? No. You got any plans? No, I don't have any plans. I'll just go there and find a place. It's no big deal. She said, I never want to go with you on a trip. I just never want to go. And I said, well, by the way, what are you planning for those 3 weeks while I'm gone? She says, I have been waiting since we moved here 5 years to take the cups out of the cupboards in there and clean back in the corners, and I'm going to put the little cups in front of the big ones. Now, that's a plan. And she's excited about this. And to make it even more depressing, it's a 3-week plan. And I'm thinking, if we're going to change where the cups are, let's do it over lunch and get this thing over with. But when she got it done, I went in there when I came back, and I said, you know, it really is nice to be able to grab the little cups without the big ones falling on me. And I thought we were going to have to refinish all these cupboards. I said, what'd you do? Well, I used this oil that's got finish in it, and I rubbed it around on there. I said, you know, that really looks good. And I've learned that success in ministry, in business, in family, in my personal life is a success because of attention to little bitty details. Details are what make it a success. And I've learned to appreciate those people. In fact, the only people that I'll work with on a consistent and steady basis outside of the country is a melancholy. They'll never change your material. They'll improve it. They have attention to quality, to control. They're actually the people who get the work done. But you see, if we don't understand the differences in temperament, then we're always trying to pull the other person there, then we're always discouraging what they are, and we're continually trying to change them. And temperament can't change. Flesh patterns can, temperaments can't. So we want to take a little temperament test and look where you're at and give you a little information about temperaments. But I think to do that, let's take about 10 minutes. You can stand up and get a little air and move around a little bit. And then we're going to hit it with some tests. We're going to take the short version of the biblical personal profile. That's done by Performax. There's several of these tests that are out there. If you want a copy of the complete thing, you can pick that up from Scott. Temperament tests have been around for a long time. That started with Hippocrates, who developed the four temperaments by looking at people. But many, of course, believe that it dates back a lot farther than that. And Paul, obviously, being educated in the Greek system, understood temperaments. And many believe that that's what he alludes to in Romans 12 and in 1 Corinthians 12 when he talks about body life and the different members of the body and how we're different and we're not all the same. But this material has basically been cloned by several organizations, and they change a little bit to avoid copyright infringements. Not that you can copyright any of this anymore. I really question that, but anyway, this is called the Biblical Personal Profile. The original Performax test is a management tool, and in a sense, it's really an unethical test. And the reason the test is given in management, there's been several thousand dollars put into this. I'm not sure it went into research. I don't think it went into mainly avoiding copyright infringement, but anyway, they put a lot of money into that. And the idea was, if you had someone that had worked for you for 19 years and they had 1 year to go to retirement, you could give them this test and find out the job they hated most and put it in it, and they'd quit on their own. So you could take a fellow who was a salesman, he liked being out on the road, he was busy all the time, he was away from home every other week and really staying busy, been at it 19 years, and tell him you got a new job for him, he's going to put second hands on clocks on an assembly line. And he just won't make it. On the other hand, you could give this test to someone and find out where they fit, if it was the boss's kid, and you could put them in a job that really fit their temperament. And one of the things some of you will see is you're asking for it if you have a job that doesn't fit your temperament. It can really drive you crazy. One fellow came to me who was suicidal. He was a driver, a choleric. And I asked him what his job was, and he sorted mail for the post office. Now, there's a lot of people that would love that kind of a job. But for him, about every hour, a little door swung open, and a tray of mail came out, and the empty tray went out, and he stood there with the mail, and he sorted it, and he'd go home and could barely keep himself from driving into these bridges. He just wanted to check out. He couldn't take it because it didn't fit his temperament. On the other hand, you can take a perfectionist, and they would really like that. They'd enjoy that. They'd be left alone as long as nobody changed those little holes where you're supposed to put stuff in the slot. Now, if anybody does that, they're going to be in big trouble. I had a secretary that was a perfectionist, and until I hired her, whenever I went to conferences, I never had anything I needed. I'd get there and didn't have my notes, I wouldn't have my overhead, I wouldn't have my Bible, this or that. And she was really good at that. And I loved to go into her office in the afternoon, and I'd say, hey, by the way, I need to use your phone real quick. And I'd grab it and slide it clear across her desk, past all these pencils that were lined up, and her coffee cup that was in the right spot, and just move it all as I went across. And then I'd call time and temperature or something and talk for a while and hang it up and then talk to her about what I needed for a conference, and she couldn't carry on a discussion. She just sat there and she kept looking and looking and looking. And I had one of these lapel pins, and whenever I was going into her office and I'd think about it, I'd turn it upside down to go talk to her. And she'd be going like this, I got the notebook sent off, and they'll all be there, and would you fix that lapel pin? And I'd spin the thing back around, and I don't know how it gets that way, okay? And so you can find the exact job, and she was well-suited in what she did. Some fellows in Denver actually decided that they would add some biblical names to these different profiles. And so that's where they came up with the biblical personal profiles. Those are what, $10 or $15 for these things? I think they recommend you pay $75 to take the test. They think a lot about it, if you do or not, but I think it'll give us some valuable information. So let's take that test, and we'll see what we come up with in terms of temperament. Okay, can you please see my little test there? It's a little, can you see it? How's that? Okay, let me show you how you take this test. There's a series of symbols in there, and the symbols don't mean anything to you at this point. There's 24 boxes, 4 words in each box, and a most and a least column. What you need to do is take this test with the mindset of how you're most comfortable. I don't want to know how you feel, or what you think you're pressured into, or what you have to be at home or in your job, because it's not a psychological test, it's a temperament test. And we only want to know how you feel or what you're most comfortable with. So you want to take it with the mindset, how would you be most comfortable with no pressure? You take the 4 words, gentle, persuasive, humble, and original. Out of those 4 words, which one most describes you? And normally what will happen is we'll narrow it to 2 words. Well, gentle or humble. Well, out of those 2, which one would you give 51% to? And I want to warn all the melancholies and perfectionists, do not sit there and look at these words till you don't even know what they mean anymore. And that's a tendency. I have a niece that has a very high IQ, and she's a melancholy, a 4-point student, and she couldn't pass her college entrance exam because she just didn't know what those multiple choice meant. And she went through, well, what would this mean, this mean, this mean? She went through that analytical process, and I said, I want you to go back and take them, and the first impression you mark, and you get on with it, and you'll do all right. And of course, she was able to pass the thing then. So you go through there and you say, okay, I think that I'm most gentle, and you draw a circle around the outside of that circle. Leave the symbol visible. Then, which of these least describes you? Which of the 4 words least describe you? And do not ask your mate how to fill that in. You can fill it in yourself, and you take the one that's least, and you say, well, I'm least persuasive. and you run right through that test, and it shouldn't take you over about 10 minutes to take it.
So don't spend a lot of time on it.